That one has some additional burden in that it's something sheriffs would have to do that evidently some of them, or their staff rather, may not always do now, but it it shouldn't be a significant thing, you know, in that most of them are probably having them sign something before they walk out the door. And I'd be happy to respond to any
questions.
Thank
you. Other questions? Would you like to take just a minute or two and go over your perception of the possession issue for a moment while we have you here?
I would.
Especially in Multnomah County, and then...
Bang the gavel if I'm taking too much of your time. And I'm just giving you my impressions. The danger of this is that this is anecdotal rather than the precise information that you get from the Criminal Justice Council. But first, law enforcement policy can fluctuate these things enormously. Just as they can in most of the victimless crimes. If any law enforcement agency wants to concentrate on a particular thing, it can immediately produce an increase in those crimes, driving under the influence typically, and especially the drug offenses and prostitution, the three that occur to me. You can have an epidemic anytime just by order of a police chief where you have those kind of crimes. Another factor that affects us in Multnomah County, and I know and I suspect perhaps all up and down the Interstate 5 corridor, and that is that there's an enormous flow of heroin up from Mexico, the tar heroin, and there are large numbers of people evidently, if the jail population and the cases tell you anything, that are in this country illegally selling tar heroin. They're particularly a burden to local communities because when they are arrested, then the Immigration Service lodges a hold on them, and they can't be released pre-trial, even though the amounts may be minute. So they occupy jail beds. They're also very expensive for the courts because most of them, while they may be able to conduct their drug business in English, they are not willing to appear in court and speak English. They ask for an interpreter, and that has to be provided at public expense, in addition to an appointed lawyer, to the point now where we have a substantial number in Multnomah County of people who a significant part of their income is earned serving as interpreters for people primarily in the Spanish language. And a lot of these are minute quantities and are at least in some cases charged as scheme or network, because one of the ways they do business is the person who does the negotiating doesn't hold the drugs. They have another fellow standing nearby, and it may have a minute quantity, a couple of dots, and these dots are minute. They look like Tootsie Rolls, and I've had discussions in court about with a plastic envelope, this is the dot here. No, that's an imperfection in the plastic. This is the dot over here. We're talking about very small quantities in some cases. And the whole inventory may be three dots. One person is holding the three dots, and another one is negotiating what turns out to be an undercover policeman for the sale of one dot. That is frequently charged as a scheme or network, because you've got at least two people involved in addition to the customer. So that I think you have put your finger on it, that just scheme or network doesn't tell you about significance. And kind of in response to Senator Hill's concerns about the big dealers, in Multnomah County, we don't see the big dealers, and I suspect that's true of most of the state because of the rather draconian penalties available in the federal system. In some cases, for instance, 12 calendar years after reduction for good time for a first offender, those cases tend to be taken into federal court. And of course, there's a mad scramble when you get a big bundle of money to see who gets it, whether it's the local police or the district attorney's drug enforcement fund or the courts to repay the cost.
We can rent our prison beds to the feds, right, and get them.
Yes, maybe get a piece of that.
That
is happening. So it tends to be the smaller cases, relatively, that are in state. I'm sure there are exceptions to that, but that's the general thing. These cases you read about in the paper with the largest quantity ever seized in X county. Usually, those are ending up in federal court.
Thank you, Judge. Other questions?
Madam Chair. Senator Schumer. Judge Ellis, could I take you back to the release arrest of,
yes,
or violation of a release agreement, and sort of lead me through what kinds of offenses, what kinds of violations of a release agreement are you expecting to catch with this?
Well, one of the ones where the release officers run into it is their monitoring. When the people don't keep different communities run different kinds of release programs, but some of them are rather closely monitored. For instance, the electronic one that gets a lot of publicity, where the person has an electronic bracelet that will report if they leave the vicinity of a transmitter in their home that transmits that they're supposed to still be there. A violation of that, the periodic urinalysis, even a thing like being charged with a new crime. If an officer picks someone up on a new criminal charge and is aware that they're on release from a court that prescribes, as many do, that you have to obey the law, the officer could lodge them for that, I suppose.
And that's what I was wondering about, because the law presently permits the officer to arrest without a warrant or probable cause to believe that a person has committed any serious crime.
Yes.
So I'm wondering if this then wouldn't broaden that to allow that arrest without a warrant or a breach of some trivial crime.
I suppose it conceivably could. The limiting factor, of course, is rather the other way, that law enforcement agencies don't want to usually tie up officers. In a lot of our communities, we're at the other extreme, where burglars are given citations, sent on their way. You've heard these legendary accounts. One, the grand jury complained about in Multnomah County, a fellow offering his identification when apprehended prowling a car in downtown Portland. And the officer wanted to know if he had any identification. He was going to give him a citation, send him on his way, and he pulled out the citation he'd gotten the night before for prowling a car. So while there might be a possibility of that kind of harassment, I think in actual fact that with the jail crowding that we have in Oregon, I wouldn't see that as a likely problem.
The purpose of this then is more to get at those who are outside the bounds of electronic surveillance or something.
The precise thing to get at is the problem of a release officer who is confronted with a violation and knows the person ought to be revoked and has no arrest authority. The defendant can just, when the officer says your release is being revoked because you obviously came in here under the influence of heroin, the defendant can just get up and walk out. The release officer has no authority to arrest. Then you have to go back to court, get an affidavit before the judge and get a warrant issued and have another officer go out and find the person again
there,
and bring them back in.
This is only applicable to pretrial release, I think.
Mm. Yeah, I think I gathered that.
So that's where we are.
Pretty unusual.
Okay, well, I won't pursue it for this point.
Yeah, well, we have a work session on it, and we'll have some time to look at it more thoroughly. So keep your questions on that.
I did want to mention one thing in connection with that just to alert you that there is an area of concern, and that is the whole business of requiring people to obey laws. That gets a little bit close to the area of this pretrial detention because of threat to the public, and that is not authorized in Oregon, would probably require a constitutional change to authorize it. It is, as I understand it, authorized in the federal system. We have clear appellate decisions in Oregon that a judge cannot consider, shall not consider, danger to the public in making a release decision. One of the recent opinions suggested that judges on their own motion should prevent prosecutors from even urging that. The fact that you know the person's going to go out and do an axe murder, the only issue under the Oregon Constitution is will they appear in court. That's a separate issue, and that would have to be dealt with by, I think, constitutional amendment to do what the federal government has done in that area.
Okay. Kathleen, let's take up 620.
Go to committee.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 620 is a very small bill, but it's very important. If Eric Wassman from the Department of Justice could come up, I think we can do this very quickly.
Good.
The need for the bill is a drafting error in the last session in having to do with the conditions that can be imposed as conditions of probation in amending ORS 137.540, which has to do with the conditions of probation. We or specific as to the conditions that could be imposed for felonies, but the way the language was drafted, we eliminated the ability of the courts to use jail as a condition of probation in misdemeanor cases. And through a number of other statutory routes, courts were doing that. However, a case got to the Court of Appeals, and in the case of State versus Wold, which I've just distributed to you a clipping about, the Court of Appeals has said, indeed, there is no statutory authority since 1989 to impose jail as a condition of probation in misdemeanor cases. Now, straight jail time could be imposed, but this was a mistake in drafting, nothing more than that. And this bill, as it's before you today, simply corrects that error by adding in that for misdemeanors committed on or after November 1st, 1989, it makes it retroactive so that none of those cases would be lost, that jail indeed could be imposed as a condition of probation. Since straight jail time could have been imposed in those cases anyway, I do not think it's an increase in punishment. I know legislative counsel had some concern about the ex post facto aspect of it. I know the Department of Justice has done some thinking about that. The bill is very important to the courts and to the district attorney, so I'll let Eric, I think, take it from here. He has an amendment to propose as well, I believe.
Okay. Thank you. Eric.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Eric Wassman. I'm an attorney with the Oregon Department of Justice, and I have with me today the Honorable Fred Aver, who is the district attorney for Polk County, who I hope can answer any of your questions regarding how things are currently being done in our trial courts. Kathleen was very succinct in her summary of the need for this bill. I would like to take that as a point of departure and just go on to discuss a couple amendments I think would be necessary to entirely fix this problem, because it's a little deeper and broader than just the language that the bill includes. I have submitted amendments, which I hope you have before you right now. The first change would be an amendment of 137550. Because of a similar drafting problem in this bill, it is not entirely clear at this point that after finding a misdemeanant in violation of probation, that the judge could impose any jail time or any sanction, whatever. The problem comes in what is currently subsection 4 of 137550. And under the current language, it says, for defendants sentenced for crimes committed on or after November 1st, 1989, the court that imposed the probationary sentence shall revoke probation supervision and impose a sanction as provided by the rules of the State Sentencing Guidelines Board. The problem is that with respect to misdemeanors, there are no rules governing sentences, so it's not really clear what the judge can do after revoking probation. On pages 2 to 3 of my proposed amendments, the language there would clear that problem up and make it clear that for any misdemeanor, the judge could impose a sanction or execute a previously imposed sanction. In subsection B, part of that change occurs, as well as a change from the word shall to the word may, in may revoke probation. I think that's really a small change in terms of what policy changes that are being made elsewhere. As a point of fact, judges should have discretion to decide whether or not to revoke probation. It's not something we want to mandate. Then finally, on the last page of proposed amendments, a new Section 3. This 1991 Act shall apply to all misdemeanors committed on or after November 1st, 1989, regardless of the effective date of this 1991 Act. This, if accepted by the legislature, would make it clear that the change was intended to apply retroactively to all cases that have occurred in the interim since the 1989 Act. That would validate all sentences that have been given up to this point and authorize judges in older cases coming before the court to impose jail as a condition of probation prospectively. And as Kathleen discussed, the research on the question of ex post facto laws would indicate this does not expand the sentence that is possible, since it does not increase the sentence but merely provides an additional sentencing option below the maximum sentence. It would not offend the ex post facto provisions of our Constitution or the United States Constitution. That is discussed in more detail, by the way, in printed testimony on Senate Bill 620, which I think you already have.
Great. Thank you. Are there questions for Eric? We have Ross Shepherd, who's also signed up. Well, let's hear from Fred and Ross. Go ahead, Fred.
Okay. Fred Aver, District Attorney for Polk County and representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Very briefly, we support Senate Bill 620, and we also support the amendments offered by the Department of Justice. The only highlight I would give is to emphasize the importance of the need of the retroactivity paragraph proposed by the Department of Justice. First of all, without that, many judges would feel it's not clear that this was intended to be retroactive, and you'd have a real split of authority around the state as to just what the legislative intent was. And we just hope whatever your intent is, that it's expressed clearly, and we urge that language. Secondly, in my little corner of the world, at least, we've undoubtedly sentenced hundreds of misdemeanants since the power to incarcerate as a condition of probation was inadvertently revoked. I don't know how many of those were sentenced to jail, but without this retroactivity clause, there's at least the argument that each of those is going to need to be brought back to court and resentenced. There are ways around the Wohl decision, and they could all wind up with essentially the same sentence that they had before, but it would require court time, district attorney time, court-appointed attorney time, and just a lot of paperwork. We feel if the retroactivity provision is passed, that that's just going to save a lot of time and money around the state. That'd be all I have.
Thank you. Other questions? Thanks very much. Ross?
Good afternoon. My name is Ross Shepherd. I'm from Eugene. I represent the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'd like to talk with you folks briefly about both these bills. In which order would you like me to address them?
Whichever. I suppose you can talk about the last one first.
Okay.
Let's just go ahead and raise the issue of 620 here.
This is 620. I certainly understand the issue it's trying to address. An individual named Wald was convicted in Deschutes County. A misdemeanor. As a condition of that probation, he was given 30 days in jail. Defense counsel appealed that, asked that the 30 days be stayed, and the Court of Appeals agreed that 30 days could not be imposed as a condition of probation under the statute as drafted. Sentencing guidelines went into effect on November 1st of 1989, and pursuant to that legislation, it was apparent that jail could not be given as a condition of a misdemeanor probation. I strongly urge you to look at the proposition that it would be an ex post facto application of law to allow jail as a condition of a probation for any misdemeanor that happened on or after November 1st, 1989, and before the effective date of this bill. And I'm certain there will be a bill in some form passed from Senate Bill 620. It remains that if somebody committed a misdemeanor after November 1st of 1989, and you pass something that purports to be retroactive, that person is facing a punishment that is greater now because of this bill than it was when he or she was initially sentenced. That's the very essence of the ex post facto protection in both the federal and state constitution. I think that you can make it prospective, but I don't think you can make it look backwards.
Thank you.
Concerning Senate Bill 619, this...
Senator Hill.
I just want to... Are you going to give us some authority? I guess counsel can look into this, but give us some authority for your...
I'll try and do that. My first look at both of these bills was today, so I'll try and do that for you. On Senate Bill 619, there are three parts to this bill, and OCDLA supports the first part, requiring the signature of the person cited. That appears to be a good idea. On the second two parts, though, I do have some concerns. It allows for a peace officer to arrest a person for an alleged violation of a release agreement. Presently, our statute, ORS 131.005, subsection 11, allows for probable cause when one is able to believe that an offense, and that there is the operative word, has been committed. An offense is a crime, which is a felony or a misdemeanor, or a violation or an infraction. So at the very least here, we have a two statutes in conflict if you were to pass this proposed language. I also suggest to you that the Chapter 131 statute that I cited to you is founded in our Constitution. Rather than finding that a crime has been committed, this would allow arrest for perhaps a pretrial detainee moving from a residence that was on the release agreement. No new crime. Perhaps using alcohol, which is not a crime, but may have been prohibited by the release agreement. So this would be clearly a change in existing law. And then the third suggestion to you, I applaud the candor of Judge Ellis in bringing to you the problem of this preventative detention, and subsection 2 of section 4, I think, runs squarely into that roadblock. And concerning subsection 1, where the sheriff has the person that is released pursuant to the federal court order agree to appear. If the person doesn't appear, the court summarily issues a bench warrant. There's no difficulty with that, and there's nothing about a new affidavit or secondary appearances. That's just done perfunctorily. And it also seems to me that if this agreement is only between the sheriff and the defendant fails to appear, we've created a new legal concept, perhaps, of contempt of the sheriff rather than contempt of the court. So on the second and third parts of these bills, I'd ask you to look at them carefully. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thanks very much, Ross.
Thank you.
That's, these are the only folks I've had signed up on the bills today. Oh, you didn't get a chance to sign up. Well, then hurry up, Paul, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. I have only one comment about one provision of one bill. That's Senate Bill 619, Section 1. And the concern I have is if the uniform traffic citation is changed with a regular 90-day effective date, there could be tens of thousands out there that are useless. So I'd ask that you take into consideration, the League of Cities prints these things. And I don't know by what schedule they do, and that's really the only concern I have, so that the ones that we have, we can continue to use.
So you want some sort of opportunity for phase-in or whatever that amounts to?
Yes.
Any questions, Paul? Thank you.
Thank
We're
you.
Into to reducing cost to counties. Okay, anyone else? Thank you very much. We are adjourned.